internet video thing. So I'm going to tell you about work that's recently appeared on the archive with Pedro Schwaller and Andy Weiler, also at CERN. So motivation, let me give a couple of different ways to motivate this idea. Motivation number one, well, we have the LHC, and it's an awesome machine, and it's looked for all kinds of different ways, to all kinds of different scenarios of physics beyond the standard model, and as yet has not found anything. But mostly the way that it's looked for physics beyond the standard model is underneath the lamppost, in this case, the lamppost of perturbation theory. And so an example of underneath the lamppost is weak scale SUSY, where we know how to calculate everything. But there's a whole slew of kinds of theories that are not under the lamppost where we don't know how to calculate anything. But that doesn't mean that the LHC necessarily can't look for these kinds of theories. So, of course, ADS-CFT is an excellent example of how we can get some access into this dark area, not underneath the lamppost. But it would be good if there are other ways for us to start to use the LHC to look for this kinds of new physics. And then motivation number two is something a little bit more concrete. We have seen dark matter in the sky. We're very confident that it exists, but we have not seen it in the lab. For example, in the WIMP paradigm, we've searched in various different ways, including at the LHC here in monojet kinds of searches, as well as in direct detection. And as yet, we haven't seen anything. There's very strong limits, but so far, no evidence for WIMPs. And so the WIMP paradigm is one way to think about how you get the amount of dark matter, but there's another paradigm, which is that of asymmetric dark matter. And that comes from the observation that the energy density of dark matter and the energy density of baryons is within a factor of five of each other. These could be orders of magnitude different, but they turn out not to be. And so where does this come from? Well, of course, the energy density is mass times the number density. And on the baryon side, we roughly understand what's going on. So the mass of the proton is controlled by QCD dynamics. The number density, well, it's controlled by what we call baryogenesis. We don't know what it is, but we know that the number density comes from having an asymmetry. There are more baryons than antibaryons, and that's what sets the number density in the universe. So then the question arises, can you get this approximate equality or this relation by having a mechanism which generates an asymmetry on the dark matter side, and in fact the same mechanism as the asymmetry on the baryon side? And well, there's a lot of literature on this going all the way back to 1985 and quite a bit of activity recently. So yes, you can do this. But these kinds of models, they typically predict that the number density of baryons and the number density of dark matter is approximately comparable, but they usually have to put in by hand. They have to assume that the masses are comparable. So it hasn't totally solved the problem. It just pushes it off into the problem of predicting why the mass of the dark matter and the number and the mass of the baryons are comparable. And so the question is, can we get both? And so if you look back at this little flowchart, well, if the mass of the dark matter arises by some similar mechanism as the mass of the proton, then possibly this can work. So, okay, everyone knows QCD, the reason the way the proton gets mass, you start off with some weak coupling, and it runs until it gets strong, and the confinement scale is roughly the mass of the proton. And so we can imagine, so there's this work by Yang Bai and Pedro Schwaller a couple years ago. We can imagine an SUN dark of dark quarks, and then the dark matter is the baryon of this SUN dark. And then you also have a massive bifundamental field, which is much heavier than lambda dark and also much heavier than lambda QCD. And the key is to search for a model with a perturbative fixed point. And so some non-trivial perturbative fixed point where the beta function vanishes. So how does this work? Well, the scales that you get for the lambda QCD and lambda dark QCD, which translates to the mass of the proton and the mass of the dark matter, they're related because you run to a fixed point for both alpha dark and alpha QCD. So, and then if you run to this fixed point from the UV, it doesn't really matter what the UV boundary conditions are. You erase all the boundary conditions, run to the fixed point. And then you have some bifundamental, which is charged under both groups. And then once it gets a mass, then you deflect the running of both alpha S and alpha dark at the same scale, and it's related. So we know the running of alpha S, above this, this is just QCD. And so once we fix the number of colors and the number of flavors in the dark sector, this tells us the running of Alpha Dark. And with suitable flavor content, then you can get a reasonable ratio of Lambda QCD to Lambda Dark. And furthermore, we know Lambda QCD, and we know the beta function here, so you can run up and get M. And so there's only one, so you get a prediction for Alpha Dark as a function of the number of a discrete parameter space, the number of colors and flavors. And so, for example, you can imagine the fixed points are alpha star, alpha color 0.1, alpha dark about 0.2, and this gives you that the mass is 870 GeV. This mass is the bifundamental. And then the mass of the dark matter is 3.5 GeV. So you've succeeded in getting an order one mass ratio of the baryon to the dark matter, and you have a prediction of colored fields around a TeV. That's cool. And then you also want to go back to the original motivation, is to co-generate the asymmetry. And so you need an operator like this one. So the D is some standard model quark. And the capital Q is the dark quark. And so phi is this mediator that deflects the beta function. It's a bifundamental scalar. Excuse me. And so if you were to if you generate an asymmetry for this guy phi, then when it decays, it will generate an asymmetry for the quark, for the baryons, and for the dark baryons. And so you've shared the asymmetry, and you naturally predict an order one ratio of the number densities. And then furthermore, the dark matter has to be strongly self-interacting. It's a baryon of the dark sector. So just like the baryons in the standard model, even if you turn off the photon, the baryons are strongly self-interacting. And so strongly self-interacting dark matter potentially solves some of the problems of collisionless cold dark matter. For example, cusp versus core, that there's an overprediction of the density of dark matter in the center of the galaxy, and missing satellites and too big to fail, that there's an overprediction of the number of satellites that we should expect to see compared to observation. So this can all be potentially solved with strongly interacting dark matter. So the general picture. You have some heavy mediator. It decays to baryons and dark baryons. The symmetric component of the dark baryons annihilate to dark mesons, which then decay back to the standard model. And this is roughly the picture of the early universe. But we have colored scalars at about a TeV. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on the LHC phenomenology of this kind of setup, and I'll take that as motivation, but I'll be sort of more general and just think about different kinds of LHC signatures. So the general story, you have a dark QCD, dark quarks, dark gluons, some lambda dark, which I'll take to be between 1 and 10 GeV. And at this scale lambda dark, you have you have dark protons, which are stable, the dark pion, which decays back to the standard model, and then the whole zoo, which decays down to the dark protons and the dark pions. And you have this mediator. So for example, the mediator in the case of the previous model is this bifundamental. But the only important point is that the mediator is much heavier than the confining scale. So the bifundamental scalar is an example. So you have this phi, it couples to both gluons and dark gluons. Color's not great. Anyway, these are different, gluons and dark gluons. But you can also have a Z prime. So it's just some vector that couples to the quark current and the dark quark current, and this has been studied somewhat at length, although not quite in this regime, in the Hidden Valley literature. And so we can take the analogy of a QCD jet and an electron machine. So if you have an E plus E minus machine, you have collisions, it's the color singlet, the initial state is a color singlet, so the final state has to be a color singlet. But if the amount of energy is much more than the confinement scale of QCD, then you produce a large number of hadrons and mesons, but they form these two jet-like structures. They go off in opposite directions. So the same thing happens if you were to produce QQ bar in the dark sector. So PP goes to QQ bar. PP is a singlet under the dark sector, and so you produce lots of hadrons, but they form two jet-like structures going in opposite directions. But then what happens to these hadrons? Well, you have, for example, in the scalar case, you have this operator that was used to generate the asymmetry. And so from this operator, you can draw this Feynman diagram here. And then the phi is heavy, so you can integrate it out. And then you match on to the chiral perturbation theory of the dark sector. And so this just generates an operator of the dark pion decaying to QQ bar. And then for the Z dark, you can tell the same story. Integrate out the Z dark, dark pion decaying to QQ bar. And so using chiral perturbation theory, chiral Lagrangian, you can estimate from this operator what is the lifetime that you get of the pion. And because the mediator is much heavier than the pion, you get a lifetime of something like 10 centimeters. And so you can, for example, generate events and see what happens where these things, these guys kind of decay. And so the proper lifetime is 10 centimeters, so up here. But because there's two effects that make the dark pions decay all over the detector at all kinds of different lengths. So the first, of course, is the exponential decay law. So it doesn't decay exactly at C tau, but some exponential distribution. And then the second is the relativistic boost. So if you have very boosted pions, they tend to fly a lot further. Yeah?
So in the standard model, normally one doesn't talk about pion couplings like that because there's a flavor group that's a natural number, so it comes with a TA, which raises it to zero.
Okay.
When you couple to things that aren't, don't have that sort of flavor structure. Do your dark quarks have their own flavor?
Yes. So in the benchmark model, you know, we've taken NF equals 7 and there is a flavor group. We have not analyzed the flavor structure. I mean, there's definitely, in principle, some complicated flavor structure, dark flavor, our flavor. There are, in principle, well, there would be bounds even from, you know, K-on mixing, et cetera, et cetera. So we haven't analyzed that.
What I'm wondering is, in your diagrams where you had a single pion coming off of two quarks, is the fact that it's a single dark pion relevant, or are you just saying that you get generically lots of dark particles?
I mean, in order to decay a dark pion, right, you have to have one in the operator, right? And this is the question I was trying to answer is, does the dark pion decay, and if so, what's the lifetime?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
The question is, well, we can talk about this more offline, but essentially, is there some worry that it's an adjoint of its own flavor group, but then the standard model quarks aren't charged under that? So that vertex must be zero?
I mean, flavor is a global symmetry that you are free to break if you want to. So it's not a worry. But yeah, ultimately, you do have to, to build a full model, you have to worry about flavor. We've punted on that. So we've just said that the couplings are order one to at least some flavor of the standard model for each dark pion flavor. But you can imagine generalizations where some dark pions are stable, some live a long time, some live a short time, and then the phenomenology becomes even crazier. All right. And the other thing, these horizontal lines are the typical tracker size of an LHC detector. And so you can see that the tracker, at least for this particular model point, it captures all of the decays. And the hot spots here, well, they vary from something like 30 millimeters to 1,000 millimeters, but it is still mostly in the tracker. And so we can go back to our little event display, and you can see that these jets, they slowly turn back into regular jets. So each of these gray lines will decay into 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that, standard model hadrons. And so you'll have a jet of little jets inside. And if you look very close to the interaction point, you see no energy at all. If you look very far away, you see just a normal jet, and it sort of emerges in the process as you go out further in R, and you get an emerging jet. And so the strategy to look for these things sort of presents itself by staring at this picture. If you do your usual LHC jet reconstruction algorithm, you'll get a jet here in this jet cone. And so one thing you could do is you draw a circle of size R, and you look for very few tracks inside of the circle, and all the energy is displaced somehow. And so if you were to do this precisely, you draw a circle of size R and look for a small number of tracks inside the circle, we can ask the question, how often does QCD do this? And the answer is not never. QCD does everything all the time. But it's pretty rare. So for example, if you require zero tracks inside of the circle of radius R, you can get 10 to the 4 background rejection for small r, and even better background rejection for large r. And even for requiring 1 and 2 jets, you can get pretty good background rejection. Of course, this depends on the hadronization. It depends on how many kaons versus how many pions you get, etc., which is not really predicted in QCD, but it can be modeled by things like Pythia. And so you can imagine tuning Pythia and getting a different answer, which is what this dashed line is. So we've tuned Pythia in such a way to maximize this quantity, to make the background as bad as possible, but still be consistent with low energy data. And it makes the background a little worse, but it's not orders of magnitude.
Have you tried using another
Haven't. Yeah. I mean, it certainly would be interesting to look at, but
using a different tune, you're still using the same model.
Yeah. But I mean, the tunes are set to data, right? So you can't.
But again, the number of vectors is highly sensitive to the.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly something worth looking at, but we only had Pythia experts at CERN, so we didn't look at other generators. And then we can try to quantify where is this background coming from. And so for small r, the dominant background, you can't totally see this, but this darker color is coming from a B hadron. So you have a long-lived B, it decays at some distance r, some displacement distance. And then for bigger r's, it's dominated by strange because the charm and the bottom have all decayed away. But then I'm asking for the absence of charged tracks, not the presence of displaced tracks. So there's another type of background, which is completely neutral jets. And those are, I mean, those can be jets of some combination of photons, neutrons, and neutral strange hadrons, K-longs and such. And this is a smaller background, and it's roughly dominated by photons, which come from decay of pi zeros, but there's the other. The other is also a pretty big component. And so now we can look at the signal. And fortunately, the signal dark QCD is already in Pythia. There are a couple papers that showed this. And so you can simulate basically all the particles from the signal. And so we chose these two benchmarks. The point mostly is that this is a relatively heavier pion in model A and relatively lighter pion in model B. And later we'll vary the lifetime, but for now we'll take model A to represent long lifetimes and model B to represent short lifetimes. But this hidden valley of Pythia, it doesn't implement gauge coupling running. It just takes the gauge coupling to be fixed. And so this turns out to make a big difference. For example, there's a couple of variables you can look at to show that this makes a difference. The girth of individual jets, without running, the jets tend to get quite a bit fatter. And what's happening is, without running, it's the CFT jets. And CFT jets tend to be very, very broad. They tend to basically spray energy all over the detector, which is not really what we want in our signal. We want something more QCD-like. And so when you put in running, it peaks like this. And QCD jets also tend to look like this in the girth, which is just the fatness, PT-weighted fatness of the jet. And then similarly, we can look at the orphan PT, so the amount of PT that doesn't wind up in hard jets. And this also tends to be much larger. There's a lot of energy spread out all over the detector if you don't implement running. So we changed the running and and put that in for our simulation. And then we can see how well our simulation is doing. So there's actually a prediction at leading log in QCD of the number of hadrons as a function of square root of s, as a function of nf and nc. The normalization is unknown because you have to somehow map partons to hadrons, but that's just an issue of normalization. And so we can see that once you float the normalization, the Monte Carlo gets very good agreement with the approximation from QCD. And then there's a question of the Meson multiplicity. So if you want to look at jets, you want to see how many displaced vertices are inside every jet. And this, of course, depends strongly on the pion mass, pion decays to QQ bar, how much energy do you have to create standard model hadrons. So for heavier pions like 5 GeV, then you tend to get 5 to 10. And for lighter, you get, this is number of dark mesons per jet. So how many, from one quark, how many mesons you produce. And that's why fewer for heavier mesons and more for lighter mesons. And so you get a large number. If it's relatively light, you can get a huge number of displaced vertices inside of each jet.
How would they, so this is all happening in the dark area, right? So you just see some bursts of energy just appearing somewhere in the tracker along the
yeah, I mean, you see a jet. So at the calorimeter level, you see a jet. And then inside the jet, you see 10 displaced vertices, all with different radii. And each one has small number, 3, 5, 7 tracks, or even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8 of tracks coming out of it, something like that.
Did you see what the effect of pilot is on this?
I mean, we can't do a full detector study because.
Yeah,
stack
n number of min bias events, right? That's your pilot.
Yeah. We haven't checked quantitatively, but we've done some estimates and shown that it's small. I'll come to that in a little bit. we can look at this benchmark of scalar pair production. So the scalar, you pair produce scalars. Each scalar decays to a quark and a dark quark. So the signal is 2 QCD jets and 2 emerging jets. And this is a colored scalar triplet, so the cross-section is like a stop, enhanced by n colors in the dark sector. So at 10, it's about 10 femtobarn for 1 TeV mass. You could also imagine this guy, which is tougher, just a Z dark decaying into 2 emerging jets. The cross-section is unknown, and there's no jets, so you don't have a primary vertex or anything like that. So we're still working this one out, and I'll focus on the other case. And so the first question to ask is, what kind of momentum do you get for the jets? The jets tend to be pretty hard. If you have, say, a 1 TeV mediator, you get jets with hundreds of GeV, and you can do fine to pass the trigger. We can use this variable and count in how many emerging jets that you typically get. For example, in model B. So if you take R and you require 0 tracks, you still get something like a 90% efficiency for small R, although it drops off precipitously as you go to large R greater than the proper lifetime. And then even requiring 2 emerging jets, which you're going to need to do to beat back the background, you can still get something like a 50% signal efficiency. So we can look at the cut flow. It's a paired die jet event at 0th order. So you can use the same kind of kinematic cuts in the paired die jet event, roughly. And that has something like a 30 to 50% efficiency for the signal. The signal to background is really, really bad at 1 TeV. Basically, it looks impossible. This tells you that, for example, RPV stops with a mass of 1 TeV is going to be extremely difficult at the LHC. Then we have this extra handle, which is the emerging jet, and it makes a huge difference. I mean, it kills, requiring 1 emerging jet kills the background by roughly a factor of 1,000. Requiring 2 emerging jets basically takes the background down to 0. So you can imagine doing 2 different radii, 3 millimeters and 100 millimeters. In both cases, the background is essentially 0. And you, for 3 millimeters, you get pretty good signal for both long lifetime and short lifetime. And for 100 millimeters, well, you kill off the short lifetime model, but you can still do pretty well with the long lifetime model.
So by the background, you mean the multi-jet background?
Yeah.
Don't you need to worry about jet plus photon?
Jet plus photon. So 4 jets, right, and 200 GeV.
Right. So I'm just worried about the photon just hitting some, causing a photo.
Yeah, I mean, we assume that the LHC can tell a photon from a jet most of the time. And then the rate for a real, if it's a real photon, the rate is much smaller than the QCD rate. You pay alpha over pi.
Yeah, but you've gone from four jets to, I mean, okay, sure, I mean, I don't, yeah, it sounds like it would be difficult to miss it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't think carefully about that, but the, you know, there's two things that go in your favor for that background, which is that the LHC is pretty good at telling photons, and it's smaller.
But usually when you see like Higgs to gamma-gamma, right, you don't, I mean, that's not the same kind of environment that you're dealing with here.
Right.
So just because in that scenario you can tell, you can see a photon converting into something else, right?
Yep. But I mean, there's also calorimeter shapes, right? I mean, the photon leaves energy only in a small number of clusters in the eCal, while a jet will leave lots of energy in size, you know, radius of 0.5, and both calorimeters. And so we can be a little bit more general from our two benchmaks, and vary the mass of the mediator, which sets the cross section basically, and the lifetime. And so these are exclusion / discovery planes for LHC 14. We've assumed 100% systematic error on the background, so we don't really know it that well, but order of magnitude estimate is okay. And you can really discover a huge section. A huge region of parameter space. You can go up to 1.5 TeV for certain lifetimes. The short radius tends to do much better. The R equals 3 tends to do much better than R equals 100, because basically any jet that passes this cut will also pass this cut, and since the background is so small, it's just wherever you can get the best signal efficiency is going to win. You do really well. So this is done at, for 100 inverse femtobarns, some run 2 kind of nominal luminosity. But we can compare model A, we can compare what happens when you add more luminosity. And this is an example of something where high lumi makes a big difference. Because of the background estimate, because the background is so small, instead of winning by root n of luminosity, you win with n. The 100 millimeter cut, where the background is really, really small, you do a lot better at high lumi. And so, we worried a little bit about pileup, and we can imagine that, well, maybe the LHC detectors can tell what the initial displacement is and subtract out the tracks that don't come from that point. But there's another way that we can get rid of pileup. So we've presented an alternative strategy, and the way this one works, you draw your little circle, and then you see how many tracks you can reconstruct outside of the circle, and add up the energy of those tracks and normalize it to the total energy of the jet. So this thing for QCD, it should be peaked at 0. And for signal, it should be peaked at 50%, because every one of these pion decays is going to be half neutral, half charged. You won't see the neutrals in the numerator of this variable. So it's peaked at 50%. But it's much more robust to pileup. Because it's momentum weighted, pileup tends to be very low PT. So pileup is not going to change dramatically the overall energy of the jet. So we can look at the distributions of these kinds of variables. So the signal is indeed peaked. It's peaked at about 0.6 for the highest jet in the event, and peaked at about 0.5 for the second highest jet in the event, although there's some tail out here where you only reconstruct one emerging jet. And as a function of R, well, it's basically flat and then falls off once you cross C tau. The background, which is plotted here now on a log plot instead of a linear plot, it's exponentially falling, but it's falling much less steeply if you take R to be 3 millimeters than if you take R to be 100 millimeters, then it falls off much faster. And you can see that here, this is this break in the spectrum at about 100 millimeters, and this is because of Bs. Bs, there's lots of neutral Bs out here, but they've all decayed away over here. So you can do the same kind of cut flow. At least for one point in parameter space. I'll spare you the whole scan, But it does really well for 100 millimeters, but it sort of fails at 10 millimeters. You can't, or at 3 millimeters, you can't get rid of the background. But you can get something like, for one TV mediator, you can get 5 sigma discovery using this method for at least relatively long lifetimes. Okay, I've given you this cool signal. The question is, we know that the LHC has a lot of interesting searches. Are any of them sensitive to this sorts of signals? So let me go through some of the more relevant ones. So there's this CMS search for decaying digests. So the model they have in mind is a displaced diget. So it's one long-lived particle that decays to 2 jets, which of course differs from the emerging jet where you have one jet basically, but many displaced vertices inside of it. Naively though, it looks kind of similar, possibly it's sensitive. And so they get this bound on their particular model that they're looking for. But they have this requirement, if you read the paper, that all of the tracks come from a single vertex for both jets. And so any track that doesn't come from this vertex, they throw it away. And so in the case where you have 10 vertices, you're going to throw away, on average, 90% of the energy, and you're not going to be able to reconstruct these kinds of events.
So this is all happening in the HDOF?
In the tracker.
Okay, so
tracker goes out to here. So the limits start to die off as you get out of
the circuit looking for this place is in the...
So there's an Atlas one, which I'll come to in a second.
Okay.
Yeah. yeah, good. So this guy, Atlas searched for displaced lepton jets, and then there's another Atlas paper, but it uses the same kind of analysis. So the model they have in mind is some long-lived thing decays to pairs or quadruplets of leptons. But the main thing that they're doing is this requirement, that the Ecal energy be much smaller than the Hcal energy. And so they're very sensitive to things that decay inside the Hcal. And so that's why, as a function of C tau, they have this kind of steep limit curve. But again, this is optimized for decays in the Hcal. So if you have a lot of decays, some in the Hcal, some not, then it's going to be very rare that all the energy ends up in the Hcal. And so again, you're not very sensitive. But there are a lot of Atlas triggers, actually, that could be potentially sensitive. They just haven't done an analysis that would pick up this kind of signal. Then there's LHCb. So this third detector is usually overlooked in terms of BSM searches. But LHCb has really awesome tracking. They can reconstruct all the B-hadrons very, very precisely. And so maybe that is a really good detector for this kind of phenomenology. But the downside is that it has limited coverage. It only covers the forward region, pseudorapidity between 2 and 5. On the other hand, it has extremely weak triggers. It can trigger on basically anything. And they do have one search, long-lived production to decaying diget pairs. So they're looking at the same kind of model that CMS is looking for. And they place this limit. They use different units for lifetime. I found this nice diagram. So Atlas is out here, higher lifetime. CMS is up here, high mass. And LHCb is this blue one. So they're all complementary to each other. There's some Tevatron bounds. But these are all going to be searching in different regions of parameter space. And they're all very complementary. So they all have discovery potential. And LHCb is really sensitive. Even with the very limited geometric acceptance, still 45% of events have at least one pion that falls inside of LHCb. So this is the cumulative distribution. More than 30% have at least 2. And if you're willing to take, say, a 10% hit of efficiency, you can get 8 or 10 dark pions in LHCb in a given event. And they tend to have relatively high momentum. So this should be something that would be very, very difficult for QCD to fake if you can really reconstruct each of these dark pions. And then there's the question that they asked us, how many charge tracks for each pion decay? And it tends to be relatively large, so certainly much larger than the decay of a B meson. So this is another handle that can be used to tell apart backgrounds. So I've given you all these... this way to find this signal, which I think is motivated, but you know, it's still sort of a narrow thing that may not be the true story of nature. And so there's the question of what else can you search for using these exact same techniques? And actually, a whole host of displaced kind of phenomena can be searched for with these techniques. So for example, lepton jets or RPV neutralinos, here you have a lot of energy. You can draw a lot of cone, and there shouldn't be any kind of displaced or any kind of tracks that are prompt. So for example, we can imagine this scenario. Squark pair production decays to a neutralino and a quark. And then the neutralino is displaced and decays via some RPV baryon number violating operator to QQQ or something like that. And so you can just apply the exact same analysis and you get really good reach plots. I mean, again, it's the same kind of reach plot but with a different model. It's even wider in lifetime range because you only have one neutralino, and so very often it will live pretty far even for the 100 millimeter cut. And then again, going to high Lumi, the bounds go off the charts, bigger than 1.6 DeV, so you can do really well. So let me conclude. So it's important to explore different ways the LHC can search for new physics. There are a lot of potential models that are out there, and not all of them have been searched for. And dark matter exists, so motivated by dark matter, you often can come across these kinds of dark sectors with hadronization, dark protons, and things like this. So emerging jets are novel and motivated, and there are no current searches that are sensitive. The strategies can reach very low cross-sections, much better than you can do for any other kinds of jetty searches. And they're sensitive to not just this, but a broad class of models with displaced vertices. And so there are opportunities for Atlas, CMS, and LHCb for discovery. We've been talking to the exotics groups, and some of them have already begun analyses for Run 2. Thank you. Small audience, so I'll get a short talk.
So after the parent is displaced, right? After that step, what's the average fraction of the energy that's carried away by these displaced vertices? Is it order
in a given
jet?
So I'm not sure I understand the question, but let me pull up a picture to help. So.
Maybe I'm just being too, if I just follow one of those paths, I just worry that it would just be seen as some kind of fluke, that you measure 10-20% more energy than...
I'm still not so totally sure I understand.
Yeah.
So...
I'm not entirely sure if I'm making sense to my thoughts. Maybe I'll think about it.
Okay.
Yep.
So how robust are the signal features when you vary, say, dark quark masses?
Well, over a region, they're reasonably robust. If the dark quark can't decay to pi, then it becomes totally different, tends to live much longer, and it decays to 3 photons or something like that. If it becomes much heavier, it looks much more like the displaced dijet search, and those searches start to be sensitive. But sort of in the 1 GeV to 20 or 50 GeV, then it's pretty robust.
Did you
guys
look at quarks at all?
Look at?
Quarks.
We're focused on GeV scale confinement. Quarks is you take the confinement scale much lower. I don't know what changes, but potentially it's also interesting.
Spend 10 minutes.